From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. This hour, we explore the role biological anomalies play in evolution. My guest is University of Iowa neuroscientist Mark Blumberg. In his new book, Freaks of Nature, Blumberg shows how a subject once relegated to the sideshow can help explain some of the deepest complexities of biology. Blumberg writes that deformities are merely alternative paths for development, which can challenge both the creature itself and our ability to fit into our familiar categories. A conversation with neuroscientist Mark Blumberg. First, this news. This is an archive edition of The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. Years ago, people would pay money to get a glimpse at them. The two-headed goat, the midget baby, lobster boy, the bearded lady. The freak shows of the carnival era inspired wonder, fear, and morbid curiosity among revelers. People watching who were thankful for the good fortune that they were not the ones everyone was staring at. In his new book, my guest today, neuroscientist Mark Blumberg, says these anomalies open an extraordinary window onto human development and evolution and make us question what, in fact, is a freak. Mark Blumberg joins us this morning. He is professor in the Department of Psychology and Starch Faculty Fellow at the University of Iowa, author of two previous books, Body Heat and Basic Instinct. He is currently editor-in-chief of the journal Behavioral Neuroscience and past president of the International Society for Developmental Psychology. His latest book, Freaks of Nature, What Anomalies Tell Us About Development and Evolution, has just been published by Oxford University Press. And in reviewing this book, the Chronicle Review writes, Mark Blumberg is a freak of literature, one of the very few scientist writers, think Stephen Jay Gould or Oliver Sacks, who can sweep us along as they try to figure out how the exceptions in the species can prove the rule of who we all are. Welcome to you, Professor Blumberg.
Great. Thanks to be back, Ben.
Before we get into the subject matter of the book, I have to confess that I need you to address the title. If I can gauge many of our listeners' reactions when they hear it, it would be the same as mine. I hear freak in the title in an academic setting. I gasp. We don't use words like that, do we? It's an ugly word and certainly not something we think of in a politically correct academic setting. Why did you title it this way?
Well, it was the working title from the start, and it was a popular title, and we never looked back. So part of it was just it seemed like the right title for the book. Yes, it is an academic publishing house, but it is a trade press as well. And we do want these sorts of books. If we're interested in science and science education, we want people to be interested in it. Mm-hmm. And this is, in reality, how people have talked about these sorts of anomalies in the past, academically, just talking about it over the dining room table. So really, it can be a jarring word, but ultimately the message of the book is not to isolate these individuals, but to include them within the whole picture, and also to make us part of the world of freaks, that we as individuals, we have much to learn about other individuals who look different, but by looking and taking into account these individuals who differ from us, we learn a lot about ourselves.
You write in the introduction to your book that your aim is to, quote, co-join the worlds of the anomalous and the normal. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you simply engage in labeling, and that's really what to call somebody a freak or a monster, the other word that is used, even in scientific circles, the word monster is what was used. The field of teratology, that root tera means monster. So it was about the study of how monsters were made. And really what I'm trying to do in writing this book for the general public is to get provide a way for people to understand what makes all of us who we are, and in considering how people are different, see how their differences teach us who we are. So let me give you an example. So one of the heroes of the book is a person by the name of Johnny Eck, mm-hmm. Who's a star in the movie Freaks, same word, from 1932. directed by Todd Browning. It's considered a classic, a movie of the grotesque. Some people just consider it a great movie. And Johnny Eck had a condition known as amelia. He was his two hind limbs were foreshortened, and so he basically developed the ability to walk on his arms, on his hands. And he's a very elegant, graceful, athletic person, very handsome actor. He looks completely freakish. He looks completely abnormal. It looks like his body just simply was cut off at the waist. Mm. And yet his ability to walk on his hind limbs, on his arms and his hands, was a remarkable feat if you think of this person as a freak. But if you just look at us and how we learned to walk on our normal, quote-unquote, limbs, on our hind legs, we go through the same process of learning that as Johnny Eck did, as learning to walk on his arms. If we just look at the perfect, if we just go to zoos and look at the archetypes, the perfect elephant, the perfect tiger, we get a very distorted picture of how nature is actually constructed.
And you bring out in your book that the clash of what we experience when we see a Johnny Eck is that the movements, when you observe them, are so fluid and seem so natural, yet the conditions, this body seems unnatural, and it's only because of conditioning that it seems unnatural.
To us. Based upon our experiences, somebody walking around on their hands just seems completely absurd. Mm-hmm. And yet, obviously, it's not. Johnny Eck was extremely elegant. And there are other examples in the scientific literature and in everyday life. There's this famous dog from Oklahoma City, Faith. Mm-hmm. Who was born with two hind limbs. The forelimbs were deformed. And this dog developed the ability in its brief life so far to walk on its hind limbs, like a bipedal dog. This was true of a goat that was born in Holland in 1939, a very famous goat now in the scientific literature. How could animals that evolved with four limbs in one lifetime developed the ability to do something that we thought it took us hundreds of thousands of years to do and is considered one of the great achievements of human evolution, walking on two legs. And yet these dogs did that. Not only that, their bodies were shaped in such a way that they were perfectly adapted, seemingly, to walk on their two legs. So their body is thrust forward, so their center of gravity is placed over their limbs, so they're perfectly balanced, and they walk with incredible agility. How does that happen? It only happens. It's only surprising to us because we have misguided notions of what it takes to develop a functioning body.
Hmm. You write also in your book that, quoting you, I do not claim to present here a grand new theory. Rather, I aim to use developmental anomalies in all their forms as leverage to help the reader gain the perspective on a subject that even experts find challenging. Now, open the door there and tell us why experts would find this challenging. What's the debate, the points of contention? Isn't it true in any junior high or high school class that people are taught that evolution progresses through anomalies that are successful?
Well, this is a point of huge contention, and in fact, the history of it, and I don't want to go through all of the details of it, but basically, Darwin committed himself very early on, for reasons that had to do with the period in which he was working, to very small incremental changes, random changes in the that produced the variability, and then natural selection coming in and sort of deciding, quote unquote, what was going to survive. And monsters for Darwin were not within the purview of normal evolution, and this became part of the evolutionary dogma throughout the 20th century. And anybody who talked about large jumps, and I'm not necessarily committing myself to the notion that, the pigs with wings theory, that's a caricature of this idea. but there were mostly people who studied development, who did not buy into this small incremental idea because they saw rather large jumps in their developing organisms all the time. So you had on the one hand this whole field of embryology, which saw these weird things happening, like in a fly you might have a foot where an antenna is supposed to be. How does that happen? That seems like a rather large leap. It's an appendage that has gone in a completely wrong direction. They saw this happening all the time, and they thought maybe this is, these processes might be important for evolution. Now, on the other hand, there are people saying, forget about that. It's random mutation producing the variability, then producing.
We should consider that in a completely separate corner and keep it away from the theory of evolution.
That's what they did. But work that was done in the late 19th century has now been sort of revitalized in the form of a new field called evolutionary developmental biology, or EvoDevo. I like many things about EvoDevo. There are other issues about it. But in general, the notion of incorporating development back into evolutionary theory, because development for a large part was kicked out.
Tell us again what development is as distinct from evolution.
Well, development is the process of how individual organisms change across a lifetime. And evolution is normally the change across generations, including speciation, the production of new species. So it's a hard thing to understand, but in fact, development, which is the engine of evolution, right? Mm-hmm. What is possible for evolution has to be what is first possible in development. If you can't develop it, you cannot evolve it. And for reasons that are really part of history, development was kicked out of the evolutionary discussion. It's being brought back in now, but still there are these resistances. And the other thing about experts not accepting this is the nature-nurture debate. This is all about nature-nurture. And, you know, the people like Steven Pinker and people who think like him, who argue that so much of what we do is built into our genes, is built in, is pre-wired, hardwired, before we're ever even born. Mm. And this is many of us think is incredibly misleading, a very distorted view of how development works. And that's really also what this book is about.
And the example you bring up there is that when you look at the human brain, you say it is not pre-programmed to operate four limbs and five fingers on the end of these two limbs. It can adapt from a very early stage to operate any number of things.
Well, if you think about it, just think about it, what happens to a young infant when it grows and its limbs get longer and or maybe it might lose a limb or all these things that happen. The brain reflects, has to adjust to all of these changes. There's no way for a brain to know how large a baby will be at each moment of its life, how much food it will get. It can't even predict what kind of gravitational environment it's going to be living in.
But could it just be doing the best it can do to adapt and not really reaching the heights that it would had it been a norm?
Well, we have to remember that organisms are the whole organism is what ultimately is adapting. And that includes the brain and its attachment to muscles and limbs and the organism's connection to the environment, oxygen, gravity, temperature, all of those things as well. So it's the whole organism that has to be taken into account, and the brain has to reflect the instantiation of that whole organism within its environment. And that's what brains do. And those of us who study brains know this very well, how brains change across the lifespan depending upon the circumstances of the body and depending upon the circumstances of the outside world.
Okay, we're trying to wrap our brains here on Iowa Public Radio around the new book just published by Oxford University Press by neuroscientist Mark Blumberg. Freaks of Nature is its title. What anomalies tell us about development and evolution? Shows how a subject that was once relegated to the sideshow can help explain some of the deepest complexities of biology. And we'll be back in just a moment. We'd like to find out your thoughts a little later in the show. Thoughts and questions as you hear this discussion. Are you encouraged? Are you offended? We'd like to know. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer, and you're listening to an archive edition of our program today. Freaks of Nature, What Anomalies Tell Us About Development and Evolution is the title of Mark Blumberg's latest book. He's a neuroscientist at the University of Iowa, just published by Oxford University Press, and we're discussing his topic here, his thesis, that how these subjects, once relegated to the sideshow, can help explain some of the complexities of biology, development, and evolution. Mark Blumberg, you go back in history to trace our fascination with, you use it in your title, freaks. It still comes difficult for me in this setting, at least. Why do we find anomalies in animals, in people, so fascinating? We view them with fascination and with horror.
Mm-hmm. Well, part of it is just we are almost trained from a very early age to look out for things that look different. Mm-hmm. And part of the way our brain works is we look for to categorize things into things that are familiar to us. And those things that stand out grab our attention and we attempt to make sense of it. Sometimes these things are so different that it's elicited some pretty horrible responses on the part, whether it's you know, in the case of Romans drowning anomalous babies, you know, deformed babies in the river, ancient Romans, that is, to the playground. These are the sorts of things that bring a lot of shame on us as individuals and as communities. But it's part of our history, and it's part of who we are, unfortunately, that we have to change.
Interesting, though, you did bring up an example, if I'm not mistaken, of an anomaly in an Indian girl, or wasn't an Indian girl, mm-hmm. Lakshmi Tatma, yeah. I have noted here. She had extra limbs right. on her body, and because this matched up with the Hindu god Vishnu, mm-hmm. it was viewed differently.
Well, I think Lakshmi actually is a name for a god in India, and so this is the multi-limbed Hindu god Vishnu. And this young girl is a case of conjoined twinning, but it was incomplete twinning. But the limbs were there of the extra twin, but mm-hmm. and then eventually she just went through the surgery, and then those limbs were removed. There's another case also in India, as it turned out, of a girl with a condition called diprosopia, which is where the two faces, the face separates. So you actually end up with, in her case, she had three eyes, one common eye and two eyes off to each side. And the face separates in some cases, and it happens in all animals, really all mm-hmm. mammals, kittens as well, it happens a lot in, where the faces can separate tremendously. So you can actually see two complete faces. This is not conjoined twinning. It's a separate phenomenon. Mm-hmm. But these sorts of things happen quite a bit. Happen a lot more often, I think, in the past, but they still happen.
Which gets us in your book to some really elemental discussions that mm-hmm. people perhaps have not asked themselves going about their daily business. When you talk about diprosopia, and the other one you address in that chapter, cyclopia, which would be one eye, mm-hmm. That condition. The design of the face. Two eyes above a nose, below the nose, a mouth. This is not a given.
No.
How did it happen?
Well, this was one of the things that blew me away when I first started doing the research for the book and going back and to the old literature. And this was a paper that caught my attention from 1908 by a person. His name was Harris Hawthorne Wilder, and he had these little drawings in his book of. These were sketches, basically. I call them cartoons of the face in all of its variety, from the cyclopia condition through what we see around us, most of us, every day, to the diprosopia double-faced condition. And what struck me about cyclopia was the first time I saw it, I mean, the first thing you do is you notice there's nothing where the nose is supposed to be. Hmm. You see one single eye, which is extremely disconcerting, and a single mouth. But there's nothing in the facial, in the mid-face region. And then there was this little thing above the eye, which I thought initially was a smudge on this old page that I had. And then I went and started looking at pictures of cyclopic infants, you know, the ones that you see in formaldehyde jars, these terrible things. And there was this incredible little proboscis above the eye. It was a little tubular proboscis above the eye. And I said, what is that? You know? And then as I read more, I realized that what happens is there is the tissue that will become the nose, is initially situated above the eyes. The eyes basically create an opening.
In an embryo.
In an embryo, all mammalian embryos. And it's a single eye field that goes across the entire eye, like a bar of tissue across. And then eventually the midline disappears, the two parts on the side become the eyes, and then the tissue that will become a nose descends through that gap to the place on the face where it can become a nose that we recognize as a nose. But if it is forced to stay above the eyes, as it does in cyclopia, because there's never a path that's made possible, it develops into a tubular proboscis. And then, of course, you go and you look at an elephant, and you say, my God, that's a tubular proboscis. So then you wonder, do you really need to have – how would you explain that? How would you explain a nose? You say, well, there must be a gene for a nose. Well, of course there's no gene for a nose. The nose, to produce a nose, requires a lot of things to happen, including the eyes getting out of the way of that tissue that is going to become a nose.
Let it move down.
It's got to allow it to move down. So then you start to realize that development, it has to include timing. Timing matters tremendously. And where that tissue develops matters tremendously. If it develops above the eye, it develops into a tube. If it develops below the eyes, it becomes what we call a nose.
You talk about timing a lot in this book. And talk about that, too, in about the different ways that anomalies are produced. They can happen through genetics, but also through conditions in the womb.
That's right. There are multiple paths, as we say, to a single outcome. And in the case, let's take dicephalic, two-headedness. It can happen in a variety of ways. The mechanisms are not completely understood. But one of my favorite examples is an animal called a British grass snake. It's a snake in Britain. And the mothers lay the eggs in compost heaps where it's warm. If it's too warm, a high proportion of these eggs will develop two heads. Now, these are basically genetically identical to animals that don't have two heads, but the conditions of the environment alter the embryonic development in such a way.
Why would the higher temperature create two heads?
Like I said, it's not completely known why temperature leads to it, but it is known that you can, for example, in tadpoles, you can create it by spinning the embryo in a certain way at a certain angle will produce this development of two heads. So there are a variety of ways to do it. It involves altering the embryonic situation around a very important time of development.
We want to invite your participation in our discussion with Professor Mark Blumberg, the neuroscientist, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Anything you heard that prompts a comment or a question? Scott in Toddville writes, I still remember visiting the Jones County Fair as a child and having my older brother take me through the, quote, savage boy attraction. A young boy who feasted on reptiles and rodents in a cage. Obviously quite repulsive, writes Scott, but something I still recall quite vividly. It remains emboldened in my memory. Hmm. We don't have to go back too far, a generation or two, to get to the carnival era.
No, in fact, I just discovered that Coney Island in New York still has what they call proudly a freak show. And it has all of the usual attractions of the old freak shows and, you know, that's their word, in case you're uncomfortable. Yeah. All of the usual things, you know, you have the hermaphrodites and you have the, you know, what they call pinheads. These are microcephalic individuals. All of these terrible these words associated that really go back to the time of Barnum, P.T. Barnum in the Victorian era, which was really the height of the fascination with
About a minute before we have to take a break. Was this how the fascination started for you as a boy, perhaps? Did you?
I wish I could say this was a longstanding interest and this was the coming to fruition of a lot. No, it really came out of certain concerns I have about the nature-nurture debate and communicating to the public how to think about development and evolution in a more fruitful way than I think it's been talked about in many ways.
Okay, when we come back, we want to field some calls and some more emails in our discussion, too. Also, we want to talk about, in your chapter, Professor Blumberg, about locomotion, how we learn to move our bodies. Again, back to that idea that an anomaly doesn't mean you have a handicap. And what part our society and the structures in our society play in handicapping people with anomalies,
right,
and not necessarily the fact that they are handicapped or disabled from the get-go. So we want to talk about that when we come back. We'd enjoy your comments or questions. 1-866-780-9100. Neuroscientist Mark Blumberg with us, Freaks of Nature, the title of his latest book, What Anomalies Tell Us About Development and Evolution. Show us how he writes that deformities are merely alternative paths for development, which challenge both the creature itself and our ability to fit into our familiar categories. Fascinating discussion coming your way. We'll take a short break and then we'll be right back with neuroscientist Mark Blumberg. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer, and you're listening to an archive edition of our program today. Talking with neuroscientist Mark Blumberg today on The Exchange, his latest book, Freaks of Nature, What Anomalies Tell Us About Development and Evolution. Professor Blumberg is in the Department of Psychology at the University of Iowa, also a Starch faculty fellow, author of two previous books, Body Heat and Basic Instinct. And in this book, he shows how a subject once relegated to sideshows can help explain some of the deep complexities of biology. And We'd enjoy having your calls, questions, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Wanted to get to the point that you make in the book about locomotion, how we learn to move our bodies. I'd like to have you talk about one of the questions you raise in the book, and fascinating. How do we account for the match that we see in different species between morphology, which is the shape and size of body and limbs, and behavior? You have examples like kangaroos, cheetahs, and humans who walk upright. And talk about that. Fascinating discussion.
Sure. So this, the other side of the book is the evolution part. And we can talk about, you know, freaks and monsters and anomalies in terms of individuals. But it's also individuals within a species, that is. But just as important are the anomalous species. So where we can learn a lot then by looking at how an entire species or an individual within a species develops, what does that tell us about development and evolution? So let's take an example. Let's look at a jerboa, which is a rodent. And it's a rodent that hops, much like a kangaroo, very, very long legs. And if you wanted to, you might say, well, this is a species. It has an instinct to hop. And that everything was predetermined. The brain was going to expect a hopping body, and the legs were all going to be designed for hopping. But then you go back and you look at a jerboa when it's born. And as somebody who studies newborn rats and newborn mice, I can tell you that jerboas look a lot like newborn rats and newborn mice. The limbs are all proportioned in a similar way. And those newborns all move around in the nest in a similar way. But jerboas are a little bit different in that their limbs start to get longer and longer. And there comes a period of time when their limbs, their hind limbs especially, are very long, but they're still very weak. So they just sort of drag themselves around with their forelimbs. Their limbs come behind like little wet noodles. And then eventually they're able to get their limbs underneath their body. But they're not very strong, and they sort of walk on all four limbs, but very awkwardly because their hind limbs are so large. And it's just still very an awkward-looking gait. It doesn't look elegant or, you know, what you would expect of a well-designed species. And then there comes an age when they are able to lift themselves up a little bit, but they're still walking awkwardly. They're kind of like we are when we have – if you wear flippers around a pool. Mm-hmm. And you're initially just tripping, and then eventually you figure out how to angle your ankles in such a way that you can avoid tripping and falling on your face. And that's what these animals look like, every single one of them in this species. And then they're able to lift themselves up and get enough strength and muscular strength in their hind limbs, and they're able to walk on them upright, you know, bipedally, and then hop around like a kangaroo. And that's what happens with jerboas. That's what we see in normal development, not this elegant solution at each stage where the animal is perfectly adapted, blah, blah. But what you see is an animal learning how to live with its body. And at each stage of its development, it learns how its body is working at that stage. No different from Johnny Eck and no different from us. So if we look at human infants and how they do their thing, anybody with a child knows that they initially go through crawling, and then they do cruising where they stand up and they put themselves on furniture, and they sort of walk around with their hands on it, and they bum shuffle, and they walk on their knees, and they log roll. They do all these various things. And I have a colleague at in New York who studies these all the diversity of human locomotion and shows it's very similar to what happens in other mammals, like jerboas, like rats, like mice. Same basic process. You learn how to move with the body you have at the moment, not you're hardwired to expect the perfect body.
So when you look at these freakish species, the message is we are all freaks.
Exactly. That's why I had no trouble with the title of the book.
You do bring up a charming story of you with your dog a few years ago.
Yeah.
And pointing out again and again the observations, the points that I loved about this book were that the very obvious things in our lives, like star-nosed moles in our gardens, that their faces are just strange. They're strange, strange creatures with all these feelers in front. Mm-hmm. Or a turtle. And you talk about... turtles are so familiar to us. If not for that fact, they would be truly bizarre creatures.
They are bizarre visually. They're bizarre evolutionarily. They evolved very rapidly. It's one of the more rapid and dramatic evolutionary changes. And somebody might say, well, obviously there was some shell mutation, you know, and that the typical explanation that we get, you know, there's a gene for a shell and it all of a sudden came. But actually what happened was these animals don't have ribs the way we have ribs. They don't have a rib cage. Their ribs develop outwardly. And that's the dramatic change with the shell, is that instead of the ribs curling around the way they do with us, they go out. And by going out, they create an umbrella on the body in which a shell develops. Mm-hmm. And in part, the development of the rib in a different location, not unlike the nose changing depending on where it develops, by the ribs changing the trajectory of their growth, it alters the cellular changes in the skin. And this in part plays a role in the development, the evolution, development and evolution of the shell of this very bizarre species.
I wanted to have you comment since about a couple things in the news that tie into what you're writing about in this book. In our last election campaign during the primaries, we had three presidential candidates, all Republicans, stated they felt that intelligent design, the idea that the complexity of particular life forms and processes can only be explained by the existence of a creator or a designer of the universe. Now, saying that they would be in favor of having intelligent design taught in science class in public schools. Mm-hmm. From your perspective, how did you view those debates?
Well, it's depressing. I mean, as a scientist, as someone who's cares about education and cares about educating the public, it's very depressing to see people taking these particular perspectives. You know, there's enough evidence against intelligent design and that perspective from a scientific viewpoint without considering freaks. But actually, when you start to look at anomalous animals, that's another place where it's very difficult to imagine intelligent design. I mean, certainly, you know, for example, no god worth his degree in engineering would produce upright humans with back structure the way we do. Well, no, I mean, this is a boon to chiropractors. So maybe God was, in bed with chiropractors. Maybe that's what this is all about. But basically, it's the worst way to design, you know, the greatest species, which is supposed to be us. But when you start adding the anomalies in, it becomes even weirder. And when you start looking at, for example, another topic which mixes in here, which is sexuality, and you start to see just how rich or how ambiguous, how bizarre is the sexual world out there, you start to wonder whether or not God has a little bit of a kinky streak to him.
That was the other point I wanted to go to, because in your chapter titled Anything Goes, you talk about ambiguity when it comes to sex and gender, and that how unsettling it is for us as individuals and as a society when we run across ambiguity in sex, and when you look at things in the news, men who love men, women who love women, men who prefer to dress like women, all of these examples there. What is at the heart of why many people find this ambiguity disturbing?
Well, part of the role of culture is to help enforce biological differences. And that is something that then, basically makes concrete that which is already ambiguous. And then over time, we've become to believe that the biological world is as clear-cut, as black and white, as the cultural layering that has been placed on top of it. And that's certainly true in the way we deal with boys and girls, how we raise them, and our problems dealing with variants on sexual orientation, gender identity, these sorts of things. One of the advantages of looking at other animals is you see just how natural all of this is. All of the different animals that come in, all of the different varieties, whether it's hermaphroditic species that have sex change, species that engage in male and female behaviors within minutes of each other. All of that variety is out there, and you begin to realize, and then when you start to look at the system that produces it, the system that produces this ambiguity in fish and all these other animals is the same system that produces our sexuality too. It starts with a testis and an ovary. It starts with hormone production, brain development, genitalia and so on. The basic biological mechanisms are virtually identical. What changes is how you develop those relationships. And then that's the advantage, again, of looking at these other animals, is you start to see just how natural ambiguity is. And then that brings us back to why we find that so problematic.
But aren't there cases that, in the case of the genitalia, that it's not purely physical, that from an early age in the womb, aren't you wired to be male or female?
No. There have been various theories. One is that you're predetermined. And the other one is that a dominant theory, which led to a lot of these surgeries that were done on ambiguous, mm-hmm. Children, or it plays out also with the the transgendered issues about whether or not sex change operations are advisable. But these two different theories, again, this is the nature-nurture debate, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is it's somewhere in between. I mean, and also to say that you know, the development of sexuality involves a cascade of influences embryonically through the, you know, birth and onward. And it requires a number of influences to happen in a particular time for you to have these particular proclivities. A lot of people now, this gets all messed up because of the whole debate over, you know, where does homosexuality come from? You know, the religious right wants to say it's a choice, and the gay community wants to say it's genetic. And I would say that they are both wrong in the sense that it's biological, but that doesn't mean it's genetic. So it's not a choice, obviously, but it doesn't mean it's genetic. And this gets into the issue of our reliance now on these easy explanations. Oh, it's in the genes. But in actuality, these things are much more complex than that. It involves lots more of biological events, more than simply gene expression.
Mark Blumberg is my guest this hour, neuroscientist at the University of Iowa. Freaks of Nature, the title of his latest book, What Anomalies Tell Us About Development and Evolution, published by Oxford University Press. An email from an anonymous listener. Does the fact that I had breasts at 22 months and was 5 feet tall at age 5, as well as an extra bone in each foot, serve any useful purpose as an evolutionary trend, writes this listener.
Well, that's an interesting question. As an evolutionary trend, with respect to an individual, perhaps not. But the basic mechanisms that are available to produce those sorts of changes, which in this case is precocial growth, right, where a lot of things that happen, say, at age 12 are happening at a much earlier age, that is within the purview of evolutionary change. So you have animals that develop very rapidly. You have animals that develop very slowly. Rats, for example, are born in a very undeveloped state. And there are other species of rodent that have the same length gestation but are born in a very mature state. So rats on the one hand come out and they're furless and their eyes are closed and their ears are shut and they're very dependent on their mom. And other rodents, close cousins, come out and they're furred and their eyes are open and they're running around and they're doing all sorts of amazing things. Changes of developmental rate is part, a very important part, of evolutionary theory.
Okay, let's go to another section we haven't touched on too much in this discussion, another section of your book titled Life and Limb, how limbs are lost, made, replaced, transformed. It seems especially relevant as we hear so many American soldiers returning from the wars, missing limbs, needing to adapt with the new body they have, the alteration to their bodies. And you write in your book, our brains are not pre-programmed to expect the presence of any appendage, whether arms, legs, or eyes. So we have what you call the illusion of a pre-programmed brain. Mm-hmm. Comment on that in the context of the war casualties we have coming home.
The juxtaposition in your question perfectly illustrates the importance of development. So on the one hand, if you're born without arms, okay, your brain is going to reflect that body, and you're going to have a representation in the brain that's much more geared towards your feet and your legs. And this is why in the people who had this condition were called armless wonders. These were people who were able to do amazing things with their feet.
Can I just break in here?
Sure.
Because as a child, as a teenager, growing up in Cedar Falls, Iowa, I was a springboard diver, amateur, and traveled around the Midwest doing competitions. And in one of our competing teams, there was a woman who had no arms, yet could do springboard diving. And it was fascinating because if you know anything about springboard diving, it requires your arms to do a lot of the rotation work. Yet she could rotate, do a 1.5, a 2.5 somersault, go in on her head. I could watch her in the grass sitting next to me, open a can of pop with her legs, with her feet, with her toes, play frisbee with no arms, standing on one leg. This is the point you're making.
Exactly. She is, as we say, perfectly able. There's nothing disabled about her, except for us, the visual image, you know. People with arms find that visual image to be disconcerting. You've obviously remembered this probably much more so than you remember the dozens of other people you dived with when you were doing that. And her brain would have reflected all of this. And her brain would have supported all of this. Without, you know, without it, it could not have worked. But to put a prosthetic device on a woman like her would have been crippling. And we don't think about prosthetic devices as being crippling, and yet that is exactly would have been what would have happened if you did that. It gets more tricky. What happens when you get to somebody like that when they're born? Do you immediately put prosthetic devices on these individuals? That's probably doing them a great disservice. But now we get into the situation. What happens when you lose your arms when you're an adult? You go to war, you come back, and you have missing limbs. And the difference there is, first, you have problems like phantom limb, where you still, your brain is still expecting that limb to be there, and there is literally pain associated with the loss of that limb. And your brain is able to do some rewiring. It's able to reprogram itself to some extent to reflect the changed conditions, but it will never be as adept as it is in the situation where if you had lost those limbs if you were born without them or lost them at a young age. And so now prosthetic devices have a very important use. And now the key is to get to a place, and this is where people are doing work, to tie these prosthetic devices into the brain so that the brain can directly control them, learn how to use them, and you can have a much more high-functioning person under those conditions.
To your knowledge, is that where medical industry is heading? Are they as informed about the things you're talking about in the making, in the development of future prosthetics?
The people who do this work may not be as keyed into the developmental issues as perhaps I would like them to be, but for their purposes, it's not important. They're trying to understand how to connect electronic devices to a brain in such a way that the brain can then control it and sense it. That's what prosthetic devices today don't have, is the ability to sense where it is. If you close your eyes, you know where your arm is in space. Mm. That's a very important ability that only comes with experience and having a direct connection with the brain.
In the same chapter about limbs, I have to ask the question after reading it. Why don't we have the ability to regenerate limbs? And there are species that do. Yeah. The newts, some newts, salamanders, these amphibians have it. Why didn't we get that one?
Well, when that gift was being handed out, we just didn't get it. And there are advantages to animals that are more prone to having their limbs ripped off to be able to regrow them. So it depends on who your predator is and how likely you are to lose a limb. Amphibians can do it. Newts can do it. What they're able to do is these limbs are like these their own little entity, and they can grow wherever you put them, like a plant.
Not after they're detached.
After they're detached, yeah. And then they grow again.
I mean, limb growing on its own.
These limbs are able to grow wherever you put them. That makes them different. Our limb buds, the little sort of the early limb parts that become the limb that we know, requires materials that come from other parts of the body. The amphibians, they don't. Now, the key for us is whether or not scientists will be able to replace those things so that we will be able to regrow amputated limbs. That is the future. That's what some major labs are trying to work on, because obviously that would be an incredible boom.
Do you see anything major standing in the way of that eventually with increased understanding that we could regenerate limbs?
I don't believe there's any reason why we could not figure out how to regenerate limbs.
Hmm. Just a few minutes left in our conversation. I want to ask you, how much do we still have to learn from the odd and unusual in our world, in animals, in us? Mm-hmm. What is there? What are the greatest mysteries for you out there as a neuroscientist studying this?
Well, it's a great question, and that's where I sort of end the book. And really, the history of this field, the history of the interest in the anomalous, is really about bodies and what bodies look like, form. But another aspect, as a psychologist and a neuroscientist, behavioral neuroscientist, I'm interested in behavior. And so the other thing that we have to learn is how do individuals develop? And one way to – and how they learn how to behave, how they learn how to move. And that's going to require some renewed emphasis on behavior. Now, a lot of people study behavior, but not from this perspective. And I believe that by focusing attention on the anomalous, we sort of break ourselves out of the habit of thinking about – this nature issue that's still with us, that things are inborn, that we're pre-programmed and hardwired. And as a developmentalist, I'm trying to, you know, many of us are struggling to figure out the right way to communicate to the public and to our colleagues how to think about these things in a more sophisticated way. So I think that we are on the verge of being able to understand individual development in a much richer way than we've done in the past. And I believe one path to do that is through this avenue.
Any reaction from your peers? For instance, your work flies in the face of some of the work of Steven Pinker. Reaction from that field, perhaps even from himself, from Steven Pinker himself?
Well, no direct reaction. No emails. Steven Pinker is a very powerful force in the world of communicating science to the public. And it is unfortunate that many of the things that he says are just not true. So he bases a lot of his ideas about how animals developed on either bad science or unreplicable science or unreliable science, all of the various things, to weave a story that he wishes to tell. And so you could view this as the anti-Pinkerian approach that I and many, many, many others are trying to take to try to provide an antidote to that sort of thinking that he does.
We'll have to leave that point to be the end of our discussion. We've run out of time. Been a fascinating hour with you, Mark Blumberg, a neuroscientist with the University of Iowa. I wish we had more time. Your latest book, Freaks of Nature, What Anomalies Tell Us About Development and Evolution, published by Oxford University Press. And it's really been a fascinating hour. Your work is fascinating. Thank you for coming in and doing this.
Thank you, Ben.
The Exchange is produced by Greg Shanley and Jeff Schmidt, our producer assistant today, Rosalind Sixby. Podcasting available if you caught part of the program, want to hear the whole thing, available at iowapublicradio.org. Theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.